supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, as many of us know, America's prison population has skyrocketed in the past three decades. And here in Pennsylvania alone, we've got 2,000 prisoners because we're so overcrowded. 2,000 prisoners are transferred to facilities out of state. And one of the unknown statistics with this prison population is that nationally, 2.5 million children in our country have a parent in jail. And you can only imagine the impact of having a parent in jail. These kids are at higher risk for anxiety, attention disorders, post-traumatic stress disorders, and so many other issues. Nearly half of all boys with an incarcerated parent wind up behind bars themselves later on in life. On our show today, we're going to be talking about what it's like to have a parent in prison and what that experience is doing to our children and their communities. My guests are Nell Bernstein. She's author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. And she's also the coordinator of the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. Nell helped draft a Bill of Rights for Children that we'll talk about later of incarcerated parents. Nell, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
We are also joined by Imani Davis, and we'll hear from her later on in the show. Her father spent 25 years in prison and was recently released. Imani is featured in Nell's book, and she's now a consultant to prisoners and their families. We're going to be hearing from her after our break. And here in the studio with me is Cecily Bradford. She's the Inmate Family Services Program Manager for the Pennsylvania Prison Society. She works with prisoners and their families all around the state. And I want to welcome you to
Thank
the
you.
Show
Thanks
also.
Thanks for having me.
Later on, we'll hear from several former prisoners currently connected with Cecily's organization. And if you want to join our conversation, our phone number is 888-477-9499. Now, let me start with you. Your book cites a survey that found 70% of kids were present when their parents were arrested and handcuffed. And alarmingly, 30% of kids witnessed law enforcement officials withdrawn weapons. What are the implications?
I'm not sure you've got that quite right. I think it's that 70% of the kids who were present when a parent was arrested witnessed the parent being handcuffed. I don't have the book memorized, but anyways, rather than quibbling over surveys, what's the impact of witnessing a parent being arrested?
Yeah.
There's tremendous trauma in witnessing a parent being arrested. Right now, we're working with our local police department to try to do what we can to help them reduce that trauma. But I guess the reason I did quibble with that is because there's trauma whether or not you witness the event. I've met kids, not just one, but many, who have been left behind in empty apartments after a parent is arrested. And only one of those kids, and obviously he was the most shocking, was there when his mother was arrested. But unfortunately, it's not that uncommon to come home from school and find you have no parent. If you've got a single mother and she was arrested on the street during school hours, the great majority of police departments have no policy or protocol about asking about kids.
Do they get training?
They don't. They don't. We're training police in San Francisco. There's a few other municipalities that are starting to do it. But looking at the research that's been done across the country, no.
Wow.
And, you know, that kind of, you talked about stigma, but I think the biggest problem might be invisibility.
Mm-hmm. Cecily, do you know what kind of training Philadelphia police have?
I don't think there are any policies or procedures on the books that train. I know DHS had an initiative where they were working with police officers just for to get them to know that this is an issue and that they were trying to get a social worker on site at one point. I don't know where that stands in the city, but I know that there are no official protocols that are currently on the books here in Philadelphia.
A parent, and I don't want to bring this up with both of you. I'll start with you. Excuse me, Cecily. A parent who gets arrested probably hasn't been living a healthy lifestyle for years. Do we know anything about the background of these families, or do we just begin knowing them at the moment of arrest?
Well, that depends. A lot of these children do happen to be in the DHS system already, but as far as us knowing who they are, oftentimes not. When parents are arrested, that's kind of when these systems come into, when these children come into the system, actually, when DHS becomes involved, because now they need some sort of placement unless there's a family that's readily available to take these children in. But beforehand, these children aren't really seen through the society.
I'll turn to you now. We can assume, maybe not safely, but we can assume that when a child has a parent who gets arrested, that child probably hasn't had good parenting for a while.
What I found in interviewing, well, pre and post my book, hundreds of kids and their families, is that there's actually very little we can assume. And actually, I'm rarely argumentative, but that's one of the last things I found that we can assume. That Liz Gaines, Imani's mother, I think, put it better than anyone, that someone can be a good parent and a bad citizen, that the things people do that lead to their incarceration may or may not have bearing on their parenting. And I think what's missed even more often than that is that whether or not they have bearing on the quality of that person's parenting, as we, you and I sitting here, not having lived their lives, judge it, but whether or not it has bearing on that, it doesn't have bearing on the quality of the child's love for the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I found, because I don't know, this is probably the 65th radio interview I've done, and a lot of them have been call-in, that people who call in, who are kind of new to this subject, miss, is they assume that because the parent is incarcerated, the families are different, the parents are different, the love between the parent and child is different, and I just can't wait for you guys to hear from Imani, because I think she speaks to that better than anyone.
Well, let me.
They're not as different from you and I as I think most of us assume.
Cecily, let me turn to you on just that issue that Nell brought up. As you know, a family therapist, I know that when a parent has a problem, or when a family divorces, children often blame themselves in their own
yes,
grandiosity for the problem. Does this happen with these families too? Do children wind up blaming themselves for the problems?
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest issues that we deal with, is the guilt that a child feels that a parent was doing whatever they were doing, whatever the crime may be, in order to, A, provide for them, or to have them to live a normalized life, as most children see it. So they see their parent as going away as being not so much because of them, but because of the lifestyle that either the child wanted to live or that the parent wanted the child to live. Outside of the guilt, there's the huge abandonment issue. While we deal with this somewhat in divorce, it becomes much more difficult because visitation, of course, is very different when you're dealing with the parent who's incarcerated. But the guilt becomes overwhelming, and they often internalize it.
And it turns into what?
oftentimes when I see a child, it's because it becomes a behavioral problem. They're in the schools and teachers aren't aware of what's going on. A lot of times that's not on the application, or counselors don't know what's going on. So it presents itself as some type of behavior problem or withdrawal issue.
Withdrawal, or, and I would imagine rage in many respects.
Sure, sure. Like we spoke of, a lot of these children, if they're not around when the actual arrest is taking place, they come home to empty homes, or, you know, to a system that's now put in place. They begin to blame the authority figure. There's a lot of resentment to police officers, a lot of resentment toward social services, because these people are put in place after an arrest is made. So they become, you know, kind of the center of focus of anger.
Nell, I would imagine, excuse me, there's larger social issues with these kids, too. There's issues of shame and being made fun of, perhaps, at school, and wanting to hide this fundamental truth of their lives.
Yeah, that does happen. And some kids are encouraged at home to keep it secret, mm-hmm. which can be toxic. I've met kids who've held that secret, believing that they were keeping it from their grandparents, even when actually they were keeping it for their grandparents.
Right.
Kids who've revealed to a teacher and felt betrayed by that instead of support, they did get stigma. Now everybody's mugshot is on the internet. So occasionally I've heard of teenagers getting a hold of somebody else's dad's mugshot and posting it on a Facebook site.
Yeah,
as a way to harass a kid.
The implications of that has to be devastating, because, sure. you know, we know that shame is one of the most toxic emotions mm-hmm. anybody can feel, and it can turn into depression, withdrawal, mm-hmm. it can turn into rage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I would love it if we could talk about some of the things that... everything we've talked about so far is what a child goes through if that child is completely unsupported in the experience of having a parent arrested and incarcerated. So much of this can be mitigated if things are done differently, and if that child gets some support around that experience.
Well, we can talk about that. As a matter of fact, Cecily, you run a program
yes.
there for kids ages 8 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the program and what happens to these kids during and after.
It's a program. It's for children between the ages of 8 and 12. We run it in conjunction mostly with the school district, because we find that that's where the children are. That's where we can reach them without having to worry about almost caregiver buy-in to this issue. It's run like a support group. We try to run it with at least 8 students at a time. It runs for about an hour and 15 minutes. And what we do is we work a lot on self-esteem and the guilt issues. On top of me saying a lot of guilt, what I've begun to see is that some, mostly males, are almost wearing this as a badge at times, which is another issue that we try to bring light to, that it's not, it may be a guilt on the inside, but it's coming out almost boastful, that this is where my dad is, this is what he does, this is who he is in the society, and it's become boastful for some young men. So we work on that issue. We also try to forge a communication between the parent and the child. Granted, the caregiver on the outside agrees to that. We think that the communication is key, because they have the credibility with the child to be able to tell them that A, this is not where you want to be, and B, this is not where you have to be. So we work on that for 12 weeks.
How do these kids do?
They do well. I think once we give them a safe place, a place to actually air this out with other children that have the same issue that they have, it becomes not okay, but it becomes tolerable. They know that they have a support group. They know that we're going to be there once a week. We're very welcomed by the school. A lot of the counselors and teachers say that they've seen decreases in behavioral problems. We've tracked report card records and absences in this program, and they both seem to have this program has a positive effect on both.
What happens after 12 weeks?
The program, although it's been run for about 10 years, data collection has not been one of its stronger points, because it was such a small program. We're looking to do a lot more longitudinal studies where SCIP is concerned. We follow the kids. We try to follow them at least for the rest of the school year, and just by matters of communication with the parent, resource guides that we give out to families and the such. Hmm. But we don't have any longitudinal studies at this time.
I want to turn to you. Cecily talked about access parents in prison, and they're the ones that can disabuse their children, I guess mostly sons, about that this is cool. What kind of access do children have to a parent who's in prison?
Well, unfortunately, it's very limited. It depends if you're in state prison or in county jail. If you're in county jail, which is where most people go immediately after their arrest, almost across the board, and again, I'm proud to say, except in San Francisco, where we just signed an agreement with our sheriff to have contact visiting for kids, all kids, mostly in county jail, you've only got the window visiting, again, with a few exceptions, which is, you know, what you see on TV with the glass and the phone. That's very challenging for kids and even traumatic for small kids. When you get to state prison, it varies tremendously in terms of the quality of the visit. But the big issue is distance. As we've built this huge number of prisons over the past couple of decades, we've tended to put them out in rural areas, which fight for each other because they provide jobs, rather fight to build the prisons. But most of the kids are in urban areas. So here in California, you know, the great majority of the mothers are in two prisons in a town called Chowchilla, which if you had tried to find a place that was further from the kids who are in the Bay Area and Los Angeles, you'd have picked Chowchilla. And they just can't get there. You know, they're living with impoverished grandmothers or foster parents who aren't going to drive 4 hours to Chowchilla.
And so I know that they're doing virtual visitation programs. Cecily, tell us how that works.
What that is, and we found that, especially here in Philadelphia, like she spoke of, we ship people to the other end of Pennsylvania. A large population of folks who are sentenced from Philadelphia go to the Albion area or the Pittsburgh area, which is the furthest that you can go from here. What virtual does, it's similar to a video conference where they come to our office, which is at Broad and Vine, and they do a teleconference between them and the inmate where they see them on the screen and they can just have normal conversation back and forth with each other. There is a fee for that, but we have that at 8 institutions. We're trying to expand it. We were just granted by the Department of Corrections that we could do this with the two institutions that are out of state where we've just shipped the 2,000 inmates to. So families can come there, especially grandparents. We found that they just can't get across state.
I would imagine that kind of visitation is almost better for younger kids than having that scene that Nell just painted with glass and no physical access. And
well, what we do, we try to encourage as much physical contact as we possibly can. It does become difficult. But this is much better than no contact at all. We do have a busing program that goes to all the institutions here in Pennsylvania where people can get across state without having to worry about driving back and forth. That's something we also offer. But virtual visitation by far is much better than no visitation at all.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Nell, do you have any thoughts?
You know, I've had the chance to see a virtual visit quite early on in Washington, D.C., and I had a mixed reaction just because at that time it wasn't working that well. The computer kept starting and stopping, and the child was getting very frustrated and crying. You know, my feeling is it's better than nothing, but my fear is that, and I wonder, Cecily, if you share this, is that the prison departments might feel, well, they've got this, let's limit visiting even further, because here, visiting has gone from 4 days to 3 days, and with the budget crisis we're in, a lot of states are beginning to limit the little bit of visiting that we have. So is it a devil's bargain? I don't know.
Ouch. That's tough to hear. Well, you chastised me, especially early for
I hope I didn't.
For assuming, but I'm going to make another assumption here. And that is that most parents want to see their children, and most children want to see their parents. Is that okay? You good with that?
I'm good with most. Yeah.
I thought she hung up.
I was rifling back through my head for the chastising.
Well,
I'll go with most. How about you, Cecily?
I would agree with most. Yes.
All right. Well, listen. You're going to have 60 seconds now to rifle through your head for the chastising, because we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Imani Davis. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Lourdes Emergency Department at Deborah is a proud supporter of WHYY. Now open, the region's newest emergency department located at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. Operated by an experienced team from Lourdes Medical Center of Burlington County, their new location will offer both ambulance and walk-in patients with access to specialized emergency care. 1-888-LOURDES or lourdesnet.org. Celebrating the opening of the new emergency department and commitment to care for Burlington County and beyond.
Pennsylvania goes to the polls Tuesday, and WHYY's news team will be there to cover the primary voting for governor, statehouse, and U.S. Congress. Make WHYY your source for election results and analysis. Join us for Primary Color, Pennsylvania Votes 2010, and election night specials starting at 8 p.m. All night we'll bring you results, reports from candidates' rallies, and smart analysis of the issues. That's Primary Color, Tuesday night at 8 on WHYY-FM.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about children of prisoners. What's the impact of having a parent in prison on a child? My guests are Nell Bernstein. She's author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. She's also coordinator for the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership, and apparently she's had some pretty good successes out there. We're going to hear more about that later. I'm also joined here in the studio by Cecily Bradford. She's the Inmate Family Services Program Manager for the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Well, we're going to hear now from Imani Davis. She is a consultant to prisoners and their families. In 1984, a young man named Jomo Davis was in Virginia visiting his children. He got into a scuffle with a drug dealer where he was stabbed, and his friend shot and killed the drug dealer. Davis was sentenced to 107 years in prison for felony murder. At the time, his daughter, my guest, Imani, was 6 years old. She's now 32, and her father, in his late 60s, was recently released. Imani Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, tell us what happened to you when you were 6 years old. Were you present there at his arrest?
I was not. My mother and my youngest brother, who was two at the time, were living in New York City. So I believe that's how it went.
And so you were in New York?
Yeah, we were in New York.
How were you told?
My father's case was somewhat interesting. There was some drama surrounding his arrest. So my father was actually underground for a year. Mm. So he kind of had left my life for the most part. I mean, I knew he was okay, but I didn't have much contact with him for about a year prior to his arrest.
Did you know why? Did you understand why?
No, I did not understand.
Yeah, you were
why. I mean, I understood, I have a huge kind of extended family village who have been around me and supporting me for my entire life. I'm very lucky for that. So it was made clear to us, as much as anyone could convince children, that it had nothing to do with us, and that it wasn't that he didn't want to see us. And, you know, he missed birthdays and Christmases, so there was always stuff for us, and Hanukkah. There was always stuff that was from him. So his presence was felt even though he was not there. Hmm. So for us, I think that there was a sense of relief when he was captured, because I then could see him. It was harder for me to not have the contact. And I think that although it was upsetting to have to see him in that environment, for us, it was somewhat like, okay, well, at least we know where he is, and at least we can see him.
That's interesting. That makes sense. I was going to say it makes sense for a six-year-old. I would imagine it would make sense for almost any age. How did you learn what he did?
Well, it's interesting. My mother, as you may imagine, was not particularly happy about the prospects of raising children that she had made with her husband alone. And part of the covenant, as they call it, that they made when he was arrested was that he would have to agree to a certain number of things in order for my mother to agree to have us have contact with him, because we were in New York and he was in Virginia, kind of on the border of nowhere. And it was between 9 and 12 hours. It's been between a 9 and 12 hour trip for us all of those years. And so for my mother, traveling that distance with small children and accepting the collect phone call bills, the deal that they made was that my father would, one, be 100% accountable for his involvement in the crime, and two, that he would be honest with us about what had happened. And, you know, what honest means when your children are 2 and 6 is very different than what it means when they're 16 and 20. So, you know, we talk about a truth fit to tell when we are talking about working with children of prisoners. And when I'm working inside with men and women who are incarcerated, we talk about age-appropriate ways of giving that information. And I was kind of lucky, I think, that the story grew and evolved as we did, because we never stopped asking. As I've, you know, most children I know, we never, it's like every visit, and parents are wondering, is my child, like, has no memory? But really what's happening is that children are processing the information as they grow and develop, and it changes kind of in their mind about what it means.
Well, in a couple of minutes, I want to get to whether that process is still evolving and growing. But first, tell us, first time you saw your dad in prison, what that was like.
First time I saw him, I don't remember. I remember being young. I think what I remember more than anything else was those first initial visits was the being processed, was, you know, waiting in line, watching my mother be very nervous. My mother, who, if you knew her, is like, can be cool as ice in almost any environment. Officers that were abrasive and rude. So I think more than really seeing him, I don't remember that as much as I remember how uncomfortable and scary the process of getting in to see him was.
Yeah. Did you, when you were young, we talked about issues of shame. Did you feel ashamed that your dad was in prison, or confused about how someone you loved could do something that bad?
It's interesting because I didn't have the conversation of that until much later. He was my dad, and I don't think that I really understood the circumstances as much. What I'll say is that I didn't know at all that there was any reason for me to be ashamed, and I'm sure Nell remembers me telling this story many times. My first day of school, you know, they ask, what does your mom do, what does your dad do? And I shared that, you know, my mom's a lawyer, my father's in prison, and I lost all of my friends except for one little girl, Carissa. And I think it was at that moment, actually, in having parents have very strong reactions to that information when their kids went home and told them, that made me begin to know that there was something I was supposed to be ashamed of, and that maybe it wasn't a safe thing to share.
Tell us about your relationship with your dad during that time, before and in the early years, first 10 years, 12 years he was in prison?
I'm daddy's little girl, and I'm the youngest of the daughters, and my father and I have always had a very, very special relationship. I think our relationship was pretty solid until about age 12. That was when I had my first graduation from sixth grade. I was going from, like, you know, one level of school to the next. I was basically going to high school at that time. And middle school, but it was in a high school. And it was a big transition for me. And I think, you know, my parents kind of, we argue about the reality of this, but in my mind, I thought he would be there because this was like this huge milestone for me. I got to wear a cap and gown, and I got to get my hair done. And he wasn't there. And that actually kind of was the beginning of a very difficult year in our relationship that I think ultimately gave way to us having a much deeper understanding. But I think for him it was the first time that he actually really understood. You know, he may have said he felt that he understood the responsibility and the impact on his children, but it really wasn't until I withdrew from him completely, I think, that he got that, as hard as prison may have been for him, that his children were doing the time with him, and that the impacts for us were huge.
When did you begin doing time? It sounds almost like, in your experience, you started doing time when you were 12.
I think in some ways I started doing time much earlier than that, because as a very small child, this wasn't the first time he was in prison. My father came home when I was 2, so he was falsely accused of a case when I was born, and so the first 2 years of my life he was fighting a case in New York City. So I often felt like there were things I didn't want to do without my dad being there. And that extended. So in terms of doing time, I think that, you know, one of the things that my mother struggled with a lot was, you know, she would want to take us to Disneyland or she would want to take us to see the Washington Monument. And I was like, I don't want to go if Daddy can't come. They'd want to take me to the zoo. I don't want to see it if he can't see it with me. And I've met a lot of kids who do that in one way or another, that kind of retard and stunt their own growth and development, or don't want to do things because they don't want their parents to miss it, or they don't want to feel like they're growing up too quickly. And so that actually was something I struggled with very, very, very young, and continued actually all the way through college. I did an extra year of high school. I left college and then went back. Definitely I, you know,
so
dragged my feet as much as I could have.
Is that why you said to Nell in the book that you felt like your childhood died for you?
In many ways. Also because, you know, the level of responsibility shifts in a home when somebody goes to prison. And so I think in many ways I became, whether my mother wanted this or not, or was conscious of it at the time or not, I think I took on the role of caregiver of my younger brother a lot. Because, you know, the pressure, particularly when men go to prison, then the pressure on moms to provide is increased, you know, doubled. And so everybody has to pick up the slack.
Tell us when you learned that your father was involved in the death of another man, and what that was like for you.
I was probably about 10, 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that Nell alluded to, which is, you know, sometimes they think that you don't know, but mm-hmm. I had older siblings, and right. I had heard rumors for a long time. So I think that was probably around the age when they kind of said, like, someone died. But as you said, you had more information than I knew you had. My father was almost fatally wounded in that struggle, and so kind of the way that it was presented to us was more, you know, for one thing, that my father wasn't the shooter, obviously, but also that the man was trying to kill my dad. And so I think that it was much later in my life, as I began to do more kind of internal spiritual work, that I began to actually deal with the reality of what it meant that, regardless of the situation, that somebody's dad was never going to come home because of actions that my father took.
Well, you also assumed, I would imagine, that your dad was never coming home.
Yes. My father had 9 parole denials before his final release, so we had been going to the parole board since year 11. And as you mentioned, my father was released last summer, so we have not even made a year of him being home. So, I mean, definitely, and without the work of some very, very, very committed and brilliant lawyers, he probably would never have come home.
Tell us about what this did to you as a child. When you look back, what your father's imprisonment, how it shaped your identity, your character, your worldview as a child and up until today?
I think the area that I can see it having the most impact really probably is in my ability to have, you know, healthy relationships with other people. You know, I have an amazing support group, and I have wonderful friends, but As I think many people would imagine, my ability to form long-term, loving, committed relationships with partners has been challenged because, in my experience, men leave, whether they want to or not. And I think with the hundreds and hundreds of young girls that I've worked with who are struggling with the incarceration of a parent, that's similar. Because if your primary relationship, which is the one that you have with your parents, turns out this way, then it's very hard to feel like you can trust the fact that anybody's going to stay. And so I don't think that I necessarily assume that people would leave voluntarily, but, you know, to this day, the fear that, you know, my fiancé would get arrested, you know, going to the store, or that my brother, you know, will end up with my dad, you know, that kind of stuff, I think you have an almost abnormal kind of preoccupation with the fact that people can leave and disappear.
So the world, I would imagine, feels less safe. The ground underneath is just less solid than it might be for someone else.
Definitely. And I think I've always been very conscious of the fact that we as a nation and we as a world can know. This was difficult for me when I was young, knowing that the world could know that something was damaging and harmful to a child and that they would do it anyway. That was a concept that I really could never understand.
Yeah. Frankly, me either. Well, you're now living in North Carolina with the aforementioned fiancé.
Yes.
And we know your dad was recently released. Is he living with you?
He is. We are actually living with him. His dream of buying a farm. And so we are here helping to get the house together. You know, one of the things that happens from being out of the world for 25 years is that your ability to manage projects and function within this society is different and very difficult. So it's been really a full-time job kind of supporting his transition and helping him to kind of get on his feet and, you know.
I can't even find a question to ask you about your experience of having him back with you. Maybe help me.
Unfortunately, it hasn't been anything like I imagined. And I think what there is to say is that we have done a terrible job as a nation of figuring out how to prepare people to come home. I think that the way that we've looked at criminal justice in this country has been to just kind of lock people up and throw away the key and not deal with them, and that we can sleep at night knowing that the bad ones are locked away. But the truth is that most people are going to come home, and we continue to cut and cut and cut programs that help people to be able to do anything when they come home, and that give people the support and the mental health care and treatment that they need. And so the consequence of that is that you send people home who are so damaged that even when it is like what you've always asked for, that they come home somebody that you almost don't know. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very bittersweet experience. You know, the wonderful thing is that I'm going to be a mother in August. And so for me, like the final, you know, chapter in my life of being able to, you know, get married and have my dad there and have a baby, I get that. So I feel very, very grateful that he will be here for that. At the same time, I think that you hold a very little girl's view of what it will be like when daddy finally gets home. And being 32 and him being 68, it's been challenging, I think, for both of us to find a role for ourselves and for each other that's comfortable and that is aligned with what we imagined.
Your story reminds me of a book title a friend of mine wrote about what happens to us when we give birth to children with severe disabilities. And the title of the book is called You Will Dream New Dreams.
Mm.
And that's what it sounds like.
With him
there, with your pregnancy, with you will dream new dreams. We've got to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk with you further and with Nell and Cecily. But before we do, Imani, I want to thank you so much. It's been so nice spending these last 15 or so minutes alone with you, hearing your story, hearing your life. I'm really grateful that you shared it.
Thank you very much for me as well.
Who you just heard from was Imani Davis. She's a consultant to prisoners and their families. Her father spent the last 25 years of his life in prison and was recently released to Imani's home. Imani's featured in Nell Bernstein's book. Nell Bernstein's also my guest. She's the author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. She coordinates the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. I'm joined here in the studio by Cecily Bradford. She's the manager of the Inmate Family Services Program with the Pennsylvania Prison Society. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
I'm singing in the rain.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Philip Fury about his book, The Songs of Hollywood. Also, 85 million bottles of water a day are sold in the U.S. What's in them, and why do we drink it? We talk with Peter Glick, author of Bottled and Sold. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And I'm ready for love.
Fellas, clean out your closets and get rid of all those big, baggy, oversized duds, because the fashion industry is over it.
The problem that American men have had for many years is that they're wearing their suits a size or two too big, the shoulders are kind of hanging off, they've got the pleated pants that they could fit two of themselves in.
We'll talk about what the new skinny clothes trend means for men next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about Children of Prisoners. It sounds almost like a bad book title, but we're talking about the impact of having a parent in prison. My guests are Nell Bernstein. She's written All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Imani Davis is going to stick with us for the rest of the show. She's a consultant to prisoners and their families. Her father spent 25 years in prison and is now living with her. And I'm joined here in the studio by Cecily Bradford. She's the manager of the Inmate Family Services Program. It's part of the Pennsylvania Prison Society. I'd like for all three of you to listen to a tape. It's just a minute and a half long. It's 29-year-old Francesca Lagalotti. She went to jail for selling drugs, and her two children, who are now 10 and 16, have been living with her ex-husband's family. She spent time at SCI Muncie, that's a women's state prison. She's now finishing the last phase of her sentence at a halfway house here in Philadelphia, and she recently participated in a reentry program at the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Let's listen.
Before I got severely addicted, let's put it that way, I went through nursing school. I was working full-time jobs. I was really, really, you know, I was living the right life. And I had a death in the family. My ex's mother died in her sleep. So we all just lost it from there. So then, you know, lost the job, lost the cars, the house, everything. And I just, you know, got involved with drugs and, you know, got involved with the wrong people. And I wound up getting in trouble. So when I first got to jail, I didn't have a relationship with the kids because I kind of gave up. It was like 2 years that I didn't speak to them. But once I went to SCI Muncie, I started writing to them. And then now I see them on a weekly basis. Every weekend I see them. But during the time that I was incarcerated, it was very difficult because it wasn't easy. Kids want you to be there, and being incarcerated, you can't be there. So it causes a lot of depressive thoughts, and you sometimes sink into depression because you want your kids bad. And you think of the things that you did and what when you went wrong and what you or could you do to change it. But at the time, when you're locked up, you have no option. You have to deal with it. So now that I'm in this phase of my sentence, I'm able to see them, but I'm still restricted that I can't see them every day. I have to get permission in order for me to go and see them. It's really, really hard on me because my kids cry when I go to leave them. So my kids are going through a lot. They've been going through counseling, and they've been struggling since I left. Even now that they see me, they're afraid that I'm going to leave. So, but when I have to say goodbye to come back to the halfway house, they really go through it because they fear that I'm not going to come back. It's very difficult. Thankfully, the family has really, really done wonderful things for the kids, because without the family, God only knows where they could have been.
That was 29-year-old Francesca Lagolotti. She spent time in prison selling drugs, and now she's trying to reunite with her children. And speaking of trying to reunite, let me turn to you, Nell, and Imani, maybe you can weigh in on this. Here's a woman who has to go through a lot to reconnect with her children. What does it take for prisoners and their families to really be integrated in a sound and supportive way?
Counseling. Mm-hmm. seriously, I think a tremendous amount of patience and counseling. I think that the assumption is that everybody will be so happy to see each other that it's just going to be a smooth transition, and I think it's not. And I think that one thing that is really important for parents to be prepared for is the fact that they really have to tread lightly as sure. they try to become parents again in the lives of their children, that they really need to respect the fact that other people have stepped in and that children have a routine and a life and a way of being that got created when they were away, and that they have to really, as difficult as it may be, that they have to be able to step back and respect that and be very patient as they try to integrate.
You know, Nell, as I researched for this show, I kept seeing parallels between returning prisoners and returning veterans of war. I mean, it's just striking, the similarities. You see that too? I think we might have lost now. Cecily, I would also imagine that when a parent comes from prison, you know, all children, like we heard from Imani, have issues of trust. Mm-hmm. So how does that get rebuilt? I mean,
time. Time. Lots and lots and lots of time. What we found, particularly with young girls to their fathers, there is this instant run and there's this big hug. But then when it comes time for some discipline or for some structure, then the father decides that he needs to tread very lightly, which is very, very, very difficult and very unhealthy, particularly dealing with young children. What we've also found is that children have a way of, like Imani said, having this big dream about what's going to happen when a parent gets home. And oftentimes it's not a release from the jailhouse door to home. There's a step down that happens. So there's this time lapse of when I can actually experience having a full-time father or mother. And that doesn't happen in real time. You know, in children's mind, the younger, the more, things are supposed to happen almost instantaneously. You say the release date is, you know, 10 years. There's another thing with our sentencing. It's never, you know, you never get out on December 25th, 2010. You know, there's always this gap. So there's always this time thing where you're expecting something to happen. But dealing with the criminal justice system, they're just not on the same time phase as a lot of these children are. So the disappointment just gets built on and built on and built on.
Well, that brings up, you know, you talk about time phases that mm-hmm. that children are involved in versus institution. Nell, do we have you? Do we have you there? No, I thought we did, but I'll raise the question with you, Imani, that Nell recommended that children's needs should be considered during a parent's sentencing, and you know that really makes all the sense in the world. But I can hear from the other side that the parent should have considered their children's needs before the crime.
Yes. And that's the case, but it's kind of like saying that when children are involved in car accidents with their parents driving, that we shouldn't treat them because their parents should have mm-hmm. driven better. And I think that it's kind of one of those times when we have to actually be bigger mm-hmm. And take responsibility for the fact that it ultimately it's the children that we'll be dealing with one way or another. So we can say, yes, the parent should have been responsible, and we can think that that's going to have some, you know, we can feel good about that. And I don't think that anybody is really advocating for people to, for parents to not take responsibility, but I think that particularly around some of the drug laws and mandatory sentencing guidelines that we have in this country, they're really not based on anything other than how it's been done before. And I think that in those cases, when we've taken away a judge's ability to have discretion, that we're doing a tremendous amount of damage that doesn't need to be done. So it doesn't mean that you know, if a parent commits murder, that because their children are small and they need them, that we, you know, give them 2 years instead of 25 years. That's not what that means, but it means that they be considered, and that things like proximity be considered in terms of sentencing, that we really look at what the long-term impacts are going to be, and, you know, is there a way for certain crimes to be able to do time in the community? Is there a way to be able to have them be released earlier to a treatment program so that they can begin to integrate? Like, so it doesn't necessarily, I think often people get scared because they think what it means is when people have children, then they're not going to do time for their crimes. And I think that we've forgotten that we've become incredibly malicious and in our sentencing, and it really doesn't even add up anymore.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye. I want to thank all three of you so very much for joining us, and just personally, I want to thank you for the work all three of you are doing.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Nell Bernstein, Manny Davis, and Cecily Bradford. Bernstein's the author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. She's coordinator of the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. She helped draft a bill of rights for children of incarcerated parent that's really gaining traction in 14 states. Imani Davis is featured in Bernstein's book about her father's incarceration. He spent 25 years in prison. Davis is now a consultant to prisoners and their families. Cicely Bradford is the Inmate Services Program Manager at the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Next week, we'll be talking about hate, why we hate, and what can be done to overcome it. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.